It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a federal judge ordered the government to reunite families separated at the border. We find out what the process might look like coming up. First, the state Supreme Court ruled yesterday that Wisconsin's cap on non-economic damages awarded in medical malpractice lawsuits is constitutional and should stay in place. The 5-2 ruling maintains a limit of $750,000 that can be awarded for pain and suffering in malpractice cases. The money for those damages comes from a statewide compensation fund paid into by doctors. Chimaine Mills is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. She's been covering this story. Chimaine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Well, give us a background on this case that ended up at the Wisconsin Supreme Court.
Well, it started back in 2011. There was this 50-year-old woman, Ascaris Mayo, who went to the hospital, a hospital in Milwaukee, with severe abdominal pain. And she had a history of fibroids, so they thought maybe that was involved, told her to go to her OB-GYN, released her. Turns out she had a severe infection. Now, she went to a different hospital the following day, and that's when they realized she had this bad infection. They gave her antibiotics, but it was too late. Eventually, they had to amputate her arms and legs because she had severe gangrene.
And so a medical malpractice lawsuit ensues. What had courts previously awarded before this ended up at the state Supreme Court?
Well, she was awarded $25 million by a circuit court in Milwaukee, and most of that was for non-economic damages. There was about $9 million for medical costs, and the rest was pain and suffering, what we refer to formally as non-economic damages. And the judge okayed that decision, said, you know, in this case, the cap is unconstitutional. Well, of course, then you had doctors' groups and attorneys for the compensation fund deciding to appeal that. They went to the appeals court where unanimous decision that it wasn't only unconstitutional in this case as it applied to this woman, but overall. And so then that's how we got to the Supreme Court.
And now let's talk about that cap. So it's a cap not on the economic damages. You mentioned there's two different things going on here. It's a cap on what people call pain and suffering, the non-economic damages. What is the cap in Wisconsin that was passed by the legislature?
Well, it's about $750,000, $750,000. And there was a time when Wisconsin had no cap. When we first started this patient compensations fund, basically insurance for doctors who are sued, there was no cap. That was in 75. Then we had the cap at $350,000. That was found unconstitutional, and then it was increased subsequently by lawmakers in 1986 to the current level, $750,000.
So this comes to the state Supreme Court, which ends up saying, yeah, the cap is constitutional. What was the argument that won over the majority of the court?
Well, in a 5-2 decision written by Chief Justice Patience Rogensack, she said that lawmakers had a good reason. They had a rational basis for coming up with this number. And the argument made to lawmakers by doctors and other groups said, if you want to keep doctors, they can't be worried about medical malpractice claims, putting them out of business. Another thing is, if you want to keep the fund big enough that it can pay out all potential claims, you need to have a cap on some of the awards. And so in their decision, justices said there was a rational basis for this cap, and therefore we think it's constitutional.
Talking to WPR reporter Chimaine Mills about a ruling from the state Supreme Court this week upholding the state's cap passed by the legislature on non-economic damages, pain and suffering, it's often called, in medical malpractice suits. So what did the justices on the losing side of this and the plaintiffs argue in this case?
Well, they say, first of all, the cap provides unequal protection because those who are most severely injured are not getting what they should. And in this case, the jury awarded $16 million for pain and suffering, and they are going to end up, the woman and her husband are going to end up getting 5% of that because of the cap.
This let's talk about what was at stake here. Potentially, from what you said about the appeals court, this could have not just affected this one plaintiff. This could potentially have struck down the legislature's cap on non-economic damages. Do I have that right?
Exactly. With the original circuit court case, the judge said this applies only to this woman, whereas the appeals court went even further and said, no, the cap is unconstitutional for everyone.
And even if they'd said, okay, it only appeals to this one plaintiff, that sounds like could have opened the door to the next plaintiff with a really egregious case of medical error also being an exception. And it sounds like the majority was not going for that.
Right. And it should be noted, there aren't a lot of these cases. In fact, Dan Rotier, who argued this before the court in April, said there's only one or two cases which exceed the cap every year. Most juries just do not award beyond the $750,000.
So is there any opportunity for appeal here, or is this a case where the state Supreme Court has ruled and it's done?
You know, they have ruled and basically said it's not in our domain to second-guess the legislature. So if it were to change, it would be up to lawmakers, which has happened in the past. We've had no cap, $350,000, then the level we're at now, $750,000. So lawmakers could, if they wanted, change the cap or strike it entirely.
So it sounds like there's kind of a constitutional separation of powers argument. I think in your reporting you said the court had said, hey, we're not going to step on the state legislature's toes. Did they argue the other way? Well, the state legislature limited what the court system could do by putting this cap in.
No, that wasn't an argument. But Dan Rotier, the attorney for the plaintiff, had talked a lot about the size of the fund. And that's one of the arguments that doctors make, is this fund has to be big and robust so we can pay claims. And he was saying the fund is way larger than you need it to be because there's so few claims. And Justice Rogensack, Chief Justice Rogensack, said that's not our jurisdiction. We deal with the legal issues. There are other people who deal with the financial issues. And so they didn't address the size of the fund.
We'll leave it there for now. Chimane, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date.
Thanks, Rob.
Chimane Mills is a reporter for WPR News. She was with us to talk about a Wisconsin Supreme Court decision keeping the state's cap for non-economic medical malpractice damages in place. Right now, it's been a roller coaster of a week for immigration policy. Around a week ago, President Trump signed an executive order aimed at limiting the separation of children from their families at the U.S. border. Over 2,300 children had been separated from their families under a policy described by the White House as zero tolerance. Many of those families have not yet been reunited. A federal judge has ordered the government to reunite children and parents who have been separated in detention facilities and set a timeline for the government. Ted Hessen is an immigration reporter with Politico Pro and the author of the Morning Shift newsletter. Ted, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Do we have a sense, Ted, of how many families are separated right now?
I mean, the number that you said of 2,300 families being separated is pretty close to what we've heard out of the Trump administration. The Health and Human Resources Department said earlier this week that it's something like 2,000 children were in their custody that could potentially be reunited. Now, whether that includes all children who've been affected by this policy, I think some advocates would argue it remains unclear.
Let's talk about this court order now from Judge Sabra. What did this order say?
Well, this order came out late Tuesday night, and the order said that the Trump administration needed to reunify these families that were separated at the border, and it needed to do so pretty quickly. For children who are under the age of five, the judge gave the administration 14 days to get them back together with their parents. And for children over that age, basically the rest of them, he gave them 30 days. So this all has to happen relatively quickly under the judge's order. Now, as of now, the Trump administration has not appealed the order at all, and it's not clear if they'll do so.
What would it take to do this?
I mean, this would be unprecedented. I mean, there have been family separations at the border before. It's been part of immigration enforcement, but never in a systematic way like this. And I think the administration is working out right now how to do it. I think there are some logistical hurdles. I mean, for one, President Trump has called for all parents who've been caught at the border to remain in detention. Unless they decide to change that policy, it could become tricky. And the reason for that is that children, migrant children who are caught at the border, can't be in detention for more than 20 days, according to a court settlement agreement. So they're going to have to grapple with the idea of maybe wanting to keep parents detained, but having, according to this order, having to reunite them with their kids.
The judge was fairly scathing to the procedures that have been used to separate families and to keep track, or the judge saying not to keep track of the families and where they ended up.
Yeah, the judge actually went as far as saying that the government will track the personal property of detainees in immigration proceedings, but he actually said that it seems like they're doing a worse job tracking migrant children here than they would for property. And he said that there's no way that this can actually satisfy the requirements of due process and that the government has to go back, do a better job, make sure everyone's accounted for, and that they have the opportunity to reunite.
Now, we're seeing stories about people in different stages of this process. In some cases, the adults of the family might be currently being detained by the U.S. government. In some cases, people have already been deported. They're either on the Mexico side of the border or back in their home country in Central America trying to figure out where their kids are, I guess. What are the different situations people are in now?
I mean, that's right. It's a really open question. I mean, you have parents who potentially could still be in custody, who could be in an immigration detention center. You have some who are in their proceedings. You have some that have been deported, and it's not just to Central America. It could be to any country, I mean, depending on where these families came from and where they were sent back to. So I think that there is a real task here, and it's not even clear to what extent the administration thinks it needs to reunite parents who were deported with their children. They haven't said much about it. Unlike, for instance, other major humanitarian issues that they might tackle, there hasn't been a big press conference where they're laying out exactly what they're doing. It's been fairly silent.
Does the court order apply to that parent who's back, who's been deported to their home country, or does it only apply to the adults currently being in detention?
From my understanding, and I'd have to look more closely, I think it's applied broadly for parents that were separated under this policy. It may remain to, I guess we'll have to see as advocates bring forward cases of people who've been affected by deportations and maybe are still seeking to reunite with their children.
Does the court order say what happens if these timelines for kids, different timelines for kids 5 and under and older kids, but if the administration isn't reuniting them on that timeline?
That's a great question, and I don't know that the judge's order specifically says it, but my understanding is that the judge or that the administration officials could be held in contempt, and that's something that's been threatened in the past with immigration policy, that if an administration official is not following a judge's order, that's certainly on the table.
One of the procedures currently in effect, and I believe the judge addressed this, the government is giving out a toll-free number for parents and children to call and try to get reunited. What is the procedure there?
Correct. This has been something that the Health and Human Resources Department has put out. It's a phone number for parents that they can call and potentially reunite with their kids. And from what top officials there have said, it's easy to use and should be able to help parents locate their children. But there have been complaints that some have used it and haven't been able to find their kids, or that some weren't even aware of the phone number and didn't know to use it.
Talking to immigration reporter Ted Hessen with Politico Pro, a court order says the federal government has to reunite children separated from their families at the border. Still questions about how they're going to go about that. Ted, I want to take a step back. We mentioned that executive order from the president last week aimed at not separating so many parents and children. But there is still this zero tolerance policy officially, I guess, in place. Things are a bit confusing sounding. Can you sort out what's happening now?
It's quite confusing. I mean, just to start off with, the Trump administration's zero tolerance policy essentially said that anyone caught crossing the border would be subject to prosecution, and that meant that families would not be exempted and asylum seekers would not be exempted. Now, the result of that, the policy rolled out in May, and as a result, we saw thousands of children separated from their parents or guardians at the border. And now going forward, pressure has built. There's been a backlash against that, not just Democrats, but Republicans as well. you know, businesses and whatnot. And we saw the president take action and issue this executive order that sought to remedy the problem. Now, his solution for that was to keep families together in a detention setting, which has introduced a whole different range of questions about whether that can be done or not. I mentioned before, there's a court settlement that actually dictates how children are to be treated in immigration detention, and it says that kids shouldn't be kept there for more than 20 days. The administration would like to renegotiate that and hold kids indefinitely, but it's not clear they're going to be able to do that. And in the meantime, you know, it raises questions about whether Trump's order can be carried out effectively.
The alternative seems to have been what President Trump and others have critically called catch and release, where this family with a child, because the child can't be detained, as you say, more than 20 days, and they didn't want to separate him from the family, they would be released sometimes with electronic monitoring and other ways. What were we doing before this?
Before this, when families were caught at the border, the typical practice was to do what you said, catch and release. And it didn't mean necessarily that someone could come into the United States and remain forever. It meant that they would get a court date, a notice to appear, and they could also be given what they called alternatives to detention. And that could be anything from an ankle bracelet to having to check in with a case management officer to having to come to an ICE office and actually make a physical appearance there. So there were ways to deal with people who came into the country without taking the step of splitting up families. It's just that, you know, the administration moved in this direction as a policy.
We're seeing reports now, children, and this has happened to some extent before, I guess, but children appearing for hearings, immigration hearings, three-year-olds appearing without their family, with I don't know what kind of representation. What's going on there?
I mean, it's not new, the idea that children could have arrived in the U.S. unaccompanied or perhaps, you know, been separated from the person they did arrive with because there were concerns about whether it was an actual relative, for instance, or concerns about whether that person, the child, might have been in danger in that person's custody. So it has happened in the past. I think, you know, it's just so shocking to see this in larger numbers. So it's caught people's attention, the idea that, you know, young children have been left to go through their immigration proceedings, you know, on their own.
Let's turn to Congress for a moment. The House failed to pass this immigration compromise, a compromise between different groups of Republicans. One of the things they were trying to solve, I understand, was family separation. There's talk of, hey, can we pass something that just deals with this family separation issue? What are we seeing in Congress?
I mean, what we've seen in Congress in recent weeks is attempts to take some action on broad immigration reform, but no success. Republicans in particular have pushed, they pushed two bills in the House of Representatives in recent weeks, and both of them were pretty closely aligned with what President Trump would like. He even came out and was tweeting in favor of one of them earlier this week. But even with that, House Republicans were not able to rally enough support of their own party to pass either of the measures. And I think the real reason for that is, and again, I should say these don't just deal with family separations. They're broad immigration bills that would reform the entire immigration system. But still, there just was not enough support amongst hardliners in the Republican Party to go out there and take a vote for those measures.
The way immigration is talked about often, it's almost a, well, immigration crisis is a phrase that people use a lot. From your perspective as an immigration reporter, is this a particularly a tough time for immigration, a high flow of people compared to the past, I don't know, couple decades?
Yeah, that's the interesting part. The number of people arrested at the border is right in keeping with the level, the average that it's been over the past decade or so. I was looking back at the numbers for May, for instance, and the arrests on the southwest border were almost identical to the average if you took the May throughout the last decade. So it's a sign that, it's not at an abnormal high, but for this administration, I think any illegal immigration is going to be a problem. And if you remember President Trump's first year in office, the levels of people trying to cross the border really plummeted. And I think that seeing them tick back up to levels that are more closer to historic norms is not something they're willing to tolerate.
Getting back to the practical side of detention, it looks like, at least for the short term, families might be detained together under this policy, though, again, there's legal questions about that. Do we know where and how and who will be in charge of them?
We don't necessarily know where. We do know that the Defense Department received a request from the Homeland Security Department to identify space for 12,000 beds for families and to have 2,000 of those beds potentially ready within 45 days. So it was a sign that they may be moving on some sort of a Defense Department facility. It's not clear exactly where it will be. That was one alternative. Another alternative would be three separate sites with beds spread up between each of those. But again, you know, these are not final. This is a request made to identify this space. You know, it remains to be seen how they move forward.
And if we see a situation where families with children are detained for 20 days and counting, once you cross that 20-day mark, I imagine we would see lawsuits from the ACLU and others?
You could see lawsuits, I mean, if the administration decides to do that, I think, because as of now, they're honoring that 20-day mark in the settlement agreement, and what they're doing is actually going back to court and seeking an adjustment. They're asking the judge to modify it to allow them to hold kids indefinitely alongside their parents. And to, you know, also waive some different regulations that might apply to these family facilities so that they're able to build them expeditiously.
There's a lot up in the air as we wrap up. Ted, what development are you watching for next?
I think we're waiting for more information from the administration on how the family reunification process is going. They've been ordered now by a judge to do it in 30 days, and that's really not a lot of time, you know, for this sort of undertaking. And as I mentioned before, for most people I've spoken with, it's unprecedented. I mean, there's been families separated before, but never done on this scale, and then trying to undo it again a month later on the same scale.
Ted, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ted Hessen, immigration reporter with Politico Pro and author of the Morning Shift newsletter. He joined us to talk about a recent court order directing the federal government to reunite migrant families that have been separated. There are many hobbies out there, but one a lot of people share is collecting stuff. For some reason, we're drawn to a particular kind of object, maybe some kind of antique or an easy-to-find object like pens. Earlier in the week, we asked for you to call our hotline and tell us about your collection. Here's one of your stories.
Yes, this is Larry Larson, and I'm in Wauzeka, Wisconsin, and I am a collector of collections, and a couple of my favorite collections are my wooden cigar box collection, which numbers in the neighborhood of 500 cigar boxes, and they date from 1870 to 1920, and it's the graphics, very appealing graphics. I also have a collection of Kickapoo items, Kickapoo Indian Remedy stuff, anything related to the Kickapoo Valley in southwest Wisconsin. Those are just two of a multitude of collections that I have.
Jim Drager joins us now, architectural historian and state historic preservation officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society. He also traveled Wisconsin for Your Stuff, Your Story, asking Wisconsinites to share items from their own collections. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Well, now you're part of the Wisconsin Historical Society, a bit of a collection itself,
yes.
And you're a collector, I understand, in your own personal life. Can you
yes.
tell us about your own relationship to collecting?
Well, I really started to get the collecting bug when I was in college. We started going to rummage sales, my wife and I, to be able to furnish our apartment cheaply, and we'd see really cool stuff, and we'd think, oh, that's a nickel, we have to buy that. And, you know, the collections, once you have more than three of something, you're a collector. And so I started collecting all sorts of things, some of which I have today and some of which I no longer have. At one point, I had over 70 bowling shirts.
Okay.
I have over 600 vintage neckties from the 1930s to the mid-1960s.
Now, I got to ask, these are items you could wear, the bowling shirts and
yes.
the ties, maybe not
yes.
at the same time.
Sure.
Do you just collect them or do you wear them if they fit
no,
you?
No, I wear them too.
Okay.
Yeah. The bowling shirts, I only have a couple left. I did give some to the Historical Society, to their collection. I had a couple of real prize ones. One was from the Point Beer bowling team, and I thought that just
That's
has to be
Wisconsin
preserved
history,
for
yeah.
posterity.
Now, a lot of us might have collected something as kids, the rocks or toys or mm-hmm. baseball cards. Mm-hmm. I definitely collected as a kid.
Sure.
Some of us you know, lose interest in collecting. Mm-hmm. Some of us stick with it, though. Why do you think people like to collect particular collections?
Well, I think there are a number of different reasons why people collect. One of them is nostalgia. You know, people buy back their childhood. My youngest sister collects bubblehead Barbie dolls from the early 1960s. And because those were the dolls she played with as a kid, you know, car collectors buy back the cars that they drove when they were in high school and that sort of thing. So nostalgia is certainly a big driver. Family memory is a big thing, too. People collect things that are related to the history of their families. Sometimes people collect things because they're documenting in some way. The cigar box collection is a great example of that. He's documenting the history and the evolution of cigar boxes over time by collecting them. Some people just get obsessed with completion. You know, it's kind of an OCD kind of thing where you...
got to catch them all.
You got to catch them all, exactly.
I want to give a listen to another caller on our hotline talking about... you know, looking back at how things have changed over time.
My name is Linda Schumacher. I collect antique cookbooks. My oldest cookbook is 1894, and my new ones are from the 1940s. I collect them for several reasons. I really enjoy history, and you can see a lot how women's roles have changed throughout the years, just by the way the recipes are different in all the books and the way World War II really changed things. That's when the convenience recipes started to come about. Also, one thing that really tickles me, beginning of each cookbook, there's always a picture of the modern kitchen. You'd be amazed at the difference between 1894 and 1940 as to what constitutes a modern kitchen. And the funniest thing, people who know me know that I don't like to cook, so they think it's really funny that I collect cookbooks.
And, Jim, that's a great story. And also, you, as we mentioned, you went on the road asking people to show you their items from their collections. Mm-hmm. What kind of things did people bring out?
It was really fascinating. It was a very, very broad variety of things. Some of the really interesting things were a young girl named Addie, who was about 6 years old, came clutching this porcelain head doll that was her great-grandmother's. Her great-grandmother brought it from Russia when she immigrated. And so, you know, it's part of the passing down of that tie to family from generation to generation. There was a man who brought in a Bible that was printed in 1816, and his family found it in the floodwaters in Dunn County in 1888. The floodwaters receded. They found this Bible, and they just thought it was an omen of some kind.
Wow.
So the family has kept it ever since and, you know, passed it down the family.
A lot of great stories. We're talking to Jim Drager from the State Historical Society, the Wisconsin Historical Society, talking about collecting, why we collect, what we collect. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'm a totally agnostic person, but I have an intense desire to be surrounded by angels and cherubs. And it's hard for me to explain why this might be. I suspect it has something to do with these objects offering me comfort and solace. And particularly, I feel that underneath the wings, there is a special spot for me.
Oh. Nancy, I got to ask before I let you go, have you been to the Angel Museum in Beloit?
No, but that has been on my list.
Got to go. I've been there. We talked to the curator on the show. You're going to love it. If you like cherubs and angels, you will be in metaphorical heaven there.
I am glad that you gave me that suggestion.
Thank you so much, Nancy, for calling in. Yeah, she's got that personal connection with her cherubs and angels.
Sure, sure. A lot of times what people collect comes out of a personal experience of some kind. You know, there's a deep personal connection that they've forged that's emotional in some way between the object that they collect and, you know, kind of the worldview.
Yeah, I wonder about the, like, there's kind of a snowball effect, because you said once you got three, it's a collection. But also, do you find that once somebody else knows you have three or more, like, oh, well, Jim, he collects bowling shirts. Hey, look, there's a bowling shirt at the thrift store or the garage sale. I'm getting that for Jim.
Absolutely. Yeah. My brother-in-law once had a collection of over 150 pictures of the Last Supper that began that way. And all of his friends would buy them in thrift shops and give them to him.
Does everybody want these collections? There's an Onion article years ago where somebody accidentally started a troll collection because people thought he had one and then started giving them to him. Do we stumble into these collections?
That was my brother-in-law's experience.
Funny. Let's go to another caller. Barry is on the line in La Crosse. Barry, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What are you collecting, Barry?
Well, I ended up collecting stuff from the World's Fair in Chicago, the Columbian Exhibition, and I really wasn't familiar with it. I knew that a few buildings in Chicago were remnants of the World's Fair, I guess, but that's about all I knew. Well, then I was down visiting my dad in the suburbs of Chicago once, about 30 years ago, and he gave me a ticket book. It was like a season pass for the World's Fair, and it was my great-grandfather's. And to make sure you didn't share it with anyone, they had a picture on the inside of the cover. So it was a personalized ticket book that you couldn't share with anybody, a season pass. And then when I got back to La Crosse with it, I realized I had bought, a month or two before that, I had bought a series of six or seven, like, picture books of that same World's Fair in Chicago. So then I had the ticket book and all these picture books that I had already bought, and that was the first two things, and then that's kind of how it starts. My wife bought me a deck of cards that had each card had a different, you know, exhibit hall on the face card or whatever. And then a friend of mine gave me a glass bottle that had a really cool insignia of the World Fair. And I've collected, I've got a spoon and a coin and all these little things that they sold at the fair for souvenirs. And it's not a huge collection. It fits in a little china cabinet thing in my basement. But it's a lot of fun when I find something in an antique shop that I'm like, whoa.
Treasure hunting. Barry, thank you so much. And that, yeah, so he's got a very specific collection.
Yes.
And that makes being in an antique store, I bet, a lot of fun. Or a garage sale, and you find that artifact that fits the collection.
Sure. And World's Fairs are very popular to collect because there were so many souvenirs produced and sold at them. They're rich pickings, you know. So it makes the thrill of discovery so great.
Talking to Jim Drager, architectural historian and state historic preservation officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society, talking about collections, and you can share yours at 800-642-1234. What do you collect? How did you get started? We're hearing on Facebook and elsewhere, Mary from Wild Rose collects maps of any kind. She says antique ones are best, but I'll take what I can get. State map, road atlas, park map, world map, globe, topographical map, anything. I just find them interesting. Danielle in Wauwatosa collects collector's editions, hardcovers, all the prints and bindings of books by American author Donna Tartt. Just a couple of the responses we've heard. You can join in at 800-642-1234. More of your calls coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad. Jim Drager is with us, architectural historian and state historic preservation officer at the Wisconsin Historical Society. We're talking about collecting, what you like to collect and why you do it. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your collection or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back to your calls. We've got Willie on the line in Madison. Willie, hi.
Hey. Well, I wish I could tell you about something fantastic and strange that I'm collecting. I don't collect anything except junk, and it's totally unspecified. But I have a brother. My younger brother has, I believe, as it's, I've understood it, he has now all, he has a copy of, he has a 45 RPM record of every song that was in the top 20 from the years of about 58 until 72.
That sounds like it takes a lot of space, Willie. Have you laid eyes on this?
Yes, I have. It's in his basement. He has it rather well organized so he can find stuff. And if you ask him for a really obscure song, he'll know about it right away, and he'll bring it right up and play it for you. Some of his records are quite scratchy and not in great condition, but he has all of them with those specificities, and quite a lot of them. And he also, he has no idea whatsoever what this of what this collection is worth.
Willie, thank you so much. So music, I imagine, has got to be a popular collecting item, Jim.
Absolutely. Yeah, people collect different styles of music. Some people collect specific record labels. Some people collect hits like that. There are special releases of records, colored vinyl, you know, box sets that people avidly collect.
Thanks a lot for that call, Willie. We'll go next to Todd in Madison. Todd, hi.
Hello. Years ago, I was an elementary school teacher, and the kids would, when they, after summer, they'd go on vacations or during the school year, and they'd always want to bring me back something, but I didn't want it to become a contest. So I'd always ask them to bring me sand if they'd go places. And back in the day when there were film canisters, it was perfect, but everyone's labeled. It had to be exactly where it is, and I have sand. A lot of university parents. I have sand from the base camp of Everest, Antarctica, Ganges River, all over the country, too, and they're all labeled. And the interesting thing is that we use them in school, and you look at some of those. There's one, I forget the island in the Caribbean, but it was made up of mostly little tiny bones of fish and teeth. So it all fits in boxes, but I have a pretty big sand collection from all over the world.
That's fantastic, Todd. That's a great story, and that's a great way to connect with, in this case, his students.
Sure, yeah, really great. Todd, you really ought to visit this park in Eau Claire County that has soils from all 50 states.
Oh, which, do you know which park that is?
I can't remember the name of it. It's north east of Eau Claire. It's a small county park. I think if you Google it, you can probably find it.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing that story, Todd. I will go next to Donovan in Madison. Donovan, hi.
Hello. Yes, my name is Donovan. I have several collections, but my most expansive collection is Godzilla's. I have over 500 Godzillas on display in my basement, ranging in size from about an inch to 3 feet. And it is a substantial collection, not only in quantity, but in its investment. And my question is, people like myself that have these, you know, rather unique collections, is there, are there places or recommendations that you can offer for people that at that certain point when you want to get rid of your collection, that you can, I don't know, donate it to a museum or a charity or some kind of a group in a way that would obviously benefit them, but also, you know, possibly keep the ooh-ah of the collection intact some way.
Donovan, thanks. And Jim, I know museums don't have infinite space, but are there options for something like
this? Well, that's a perennial issue of collectors, is what to do with your collection when you're at the end of collecting. And some people start collections like the Angel Museum in Beloit or the Quilt Museum near Cedarburg. Historical museums will generally only take the collection if it has a tie to that, to the history of the place. The Wisconsin Historical Society, we're the largest collector in Wisconsin. We have massive, massive collections, but the things that we collect are things that tell the history of the state, and we know where they came from and what the provenance of them is. So Godzilla collection is not a great prospect for our museum, but you may find that there is there are so many unique small museums now that are kind of quirky popular history museums that may take something like that, and it's a matter of just of looking around and trying to find that right fit.
Good luck finding a home for your 500 Godzillas, Donovan.
We are never have enough.
Never have too many Godzillas. Talking to Jim Drager from the Wisconsin Historical Society about collecting, what people collect and why. Let's take another caller. Paul is with us in Big Bend. Paul, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Paul. I'm 73 years old, and I have to tell you, I've been collecting wood stoves.
Wow.
Yeah, I've had over probably 200 or so, and I'm down to about 140. And the reason I collected wood stoves, I think, is when I started my life in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, way back when. My dad got out of the service, and there wasn't housing for a lot of these soldiers. And what happened was they put the soldiers up in army barracks all over Milwaukee.
Sure.
and I lived in an Army barracks on Dakota, just on the other side of Chase Avenue. And in that Army barracks, they had four units to each barracks. There was pine floors with tar paper roof and the tar paper siding. But in the middle of that structure was a wood-burning or a coal-burning stove. Mm-hmm. And I can remember running around in diapers and feeling the heat, the wonderful heat from those stoves. And ever since that time, I have been collecting. And by the way, I heat with wood 100%.
I hope so.
Absolutely. The gas company's been out here many times to check my meter.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that story. Well, there's your nostalgia, Jim. Doesn't get more nostalgic than that for a collection.
And personal history coming
Definitely.
Out of a personal experience.
That's
sure.
a big item to collect, though.
That one would require a little room.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Paul. Denise is with us next in Sparta. Denise, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to tell us about, Denise?
Well, I collect vintage porcelain or ceramic dog figurines.
And how big a collection do you have now?
Well, it's between 150 and 175.
Wow.
Just last weekend, I was in Columbus, north of Madison, at the antique shop and scored a few more.
Now, do you have, when you're in the antique store, are you looking for any old porcelain dog, or do you have, you know, I don't have this breed, for example, yet?
Well, unfortunately, some of my dogs are duplicates, and I try not to buy any more spaniels now because I have a lot of spaniels. I try to stay away from any ones that have crazy eyes because, of course, they're all hand-painted. And if a dog figurine has crazy eyes, it's not coming to my collection.
Now I want somebody to have the crazy eye dog figurine collection.
All in if you have that.
Because you're not competing with Denise if that's the case. Porcelain figures, I imagine there are a lot of people, whether it's cherubs, as we heard earlier, dogs, that kind of thing.
Very, very common because they're small. And, you know, they don't take up all that much space until you get about 150 or 175.
175 anything, you're taking up some room. Time for another call or two, maybe. Jason with us in Janesville now. Jason, hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What's your collection?
Well, it's not mine, and it's my wife, and I hope she's not listening.
Uh-oh.
She has countless... I couldn't even give you a number, but she's been collecting briar horses for about 25 years, and a lot have been passed down even from her mother. And they're all in the same original boxes, never been opened, never been touched, as far as the horses themselves. Some of them date back, I believe, as far as the 50s or maybe even earlier. And I've been trying to get her to free up some of my closet space for years, but I don't think that's ever going to happen.
So you support her collection, but maybe you think it's reached a peak.
Share that.
Yeah, it can be tough. A briar horse, apparently not a living horse. I was worried.
Right.
I had 1,000 of those around the house. Thanks a lot for that call, Jason. Running out of time here, Jim. People love collecting.
They absolutely do. Yeah, I think everyone, my personal feelings, everyone's a historian, and collecting is a way that you touch with history, whether it's personal or larger.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Talking to Jim Drager from the Wisconsin Historical Society about collecting. People are sharing their collections with us in person and over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Mindy from Shiocton says she collects wheat pennies. They're getting harder to find. Carly from Lake Geneva collects keychains from every state she visits, has over 30 keychains from Minnesota, to countries too, to Sweden. Share your collection with pictures if you want. You can do that over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hey, I don't know if you could hear that, but there was an exclamation point after my voice there. Why? I just saw an article today in The Atlantic about exclamation points, and it looks like people are using them more and more in emails and other electronic communications. There's exclamation inflation, I think somebody called it. And I don't think our producer, Bill, is looking, so surprise him. If you're at your email right now, please send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Enter that in, ideas@wpr.org. Send him nothing but exclamation points in the subject line and the message. So ready, go. Email your exclamation points to ideas@WPR.org. Now, the thing that's going on here with this exclamation inflation, and I feel this myself, is language in emails looks really cold. So I feel like if I say thanks at the end of an email with a period or nothing, and people who know me think I'm trying to sound sarcastic, so thanks, thank you. So you put in that exclamation point, thank you. It makes it sound friendly, but then you hear it again and again in life, don't use exclamation points, it makes you look silly. Well, the trend seems to be more exclamation points, and now one isn't always enough. People are doing three or five at a time. So again, email, you could talk about whether you use exclamation points, but do it with lots of exclamation points at ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.